I'm going to call the Elections Finance and Government Operations Committee to order, and I'm going to read some agreed-upon things. Expectations of the audience and committee rules. The committee expects proper decorum at all times. All dialogue goes through the chair. Testimony will be limited to those who have signed up prior to the testimony deadline and who are listed on the agenda. Signs are not permitted in the committee room. There will be no outbursts or clapping from the audience. There is no standing or sitting in the aisles or walkways. If accommodation is needed, please communicate with the sergeant staff. And there will be consequences if there's a disruption. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since you mentioned the committee sign-up deadline, I got the email notification about the agenda for this meeting. It was 4:31 p.m. on Thursday. I'm just wondering, is that when the public got notified about the agenda of this meeting? Because then the deadline to sign up would be at noon on Friday, which is less than 24 hours. It's, you know, most of the workday on Thursday is already gone. So I guess, you know, will there be an opportunity for people who have not signed up to testify? I know a couple times you've asked if anyone in the room is able to testify also. Will you do that on these bills as well?
Representative Freiberg, because there have been threats to staff, we are going to abide by what I have stated at the beginning. And we were advised with discussions with the Sergeant of Arms, because there have been other committee meetings of where there have been activities that we do not want to have in this committee. We're abiding by what has been stated. Representative Freiberg.
Thanks. I know there was a discussion about this on a staff level, so I'd heard that as well, and we checked in with the sergeant's office as a result. They explained that it's kind of beyond their scope to actually recommend limiting in-person testimony unless there is a concrete threat to the public. And they said there wasn't here, so I would just, you know, request very strongly that you allow additional testimony. I think given the controversial nature of the bills that are before us today, I think that would be very appropriate. And I know there's at least one person who requested to testify at, you know, a few hours after the deadline, is here today and is able to do so. So would you be willing to do that?
Representative Freiberg, I have talked with multiple staff. There have been threats. I do not take that lightly. And we will abide by the rules as stated. And why don't we proceed with our agenda? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. I know there are people who are in the audience who wish to testify. I know of one specifically. Would it be permissible for me to ask them to come up individually if I have questions for them that where they can shed some light on things that have come up during the other testimony?
Representative Freiberg, do you have an agenda?
Yes, I know which bills are on the agenda.
Okay, you have the agenda with a list of testifiers listed?
I do.
Okay.
That doesn't answer my question.
No, your question was answered with what I stated at the beginning, so it's redundant. Representative Altendorf, you had a motion on the minutes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have reviewed the minutes, and I move the approval of the March 12th committee minutes.
Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. And the first bill before us is House File 1051. And as the author approaches the table, I'd also like Heidi Nelson and Daniel Lightfoot to have seats so that we can proceed in an orderly fashion. I would move that House File 1051 be before the committee and be held or possibly laid over for possible inclusion to the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have an author's amendment, the A3. Would someone move that for me?
Representative Davis has moved to A3.
Great.
Proceed, author.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think it's the A1. Can we just clarify?
Representative Lee, in my packet, I have one that's H1051A3.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So you must be looking at a different bill.
That's right. My apologies. Thanks. Okay.
Thank you. To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am bringing 1051 as amended, and the key point is as amended. So this is an update to the bill that was passed last session called the Sacred Settlements Act, which allows churches to put micro-homes on their properties to help address homelessness. And I am fully in support of that mission. I really care about churches being able to live out their faith-filled identity and mission in the public square. And that is why I'm bringing this bill and this amendment. And so I think the original bill probably wasn't, after conversations, what I intended. So the A3 reflects my intentions. And so for those of you who only looked at the bill and not the amended version of the bill, I just want you to understand that my heart in this is to make sacred settlements work and be successful. And I think we need guardrails around that for that to happen. So my framework of reference for this is I have been active in my church my entire life. I have been on the board of my church's food shelf. I was a founding member of my church's food shelf board. And I also sent my kids to a church-based preschool. And churches can absolutely live out their mission in the public square and fulfill their faith identity while also being subject to reasonable health and safety regulations that are subject to other similar service providers. So the food shelf that I was on the board of, we had a very faith-filled mission, but we also had to make sure the freezer temperatures were right. We also had to make sure there were certain cleanliness standards. We also had to make sure fresh produce was only treated in certain ways. Similar with my kids going to a church-based preschool. There were health and safety regulations. There were staffing ratios, but that didn't impinge at all on their ability to carry out their faith mission. And so I just want the public to be very well aware of my commitment to ensuring religious liberty and to people pursuing their faith mission in the public square. That being said, there were problems that in discussions with advocates we came across and wanted to really work out the relationship between the city and the community. And so in the A3, we do require electric utilities. In the original Sacred Settlements bill, it was an or. And in talking through that with advocates, I think they also agreed that some level of electric utility to the unit is good and that that should be addressed by an actual electrician and make sure everything's safe. And then the other part is that cities can have a licensing requirement that cannot be more strict. And I have to tell you, members, we were working all weekend on an update to this amendment that would limit any city licensing requirements to what's already in landlord-tenant law in Section 504 of statute. And we just couldn't quite get it, honestly, this morning because I had committee right until noon. But we were literally working all through the morning to try and get this ready for committee. So my intention, and I'm sure you'll hear that from the advocates as well, is to keep working on this. And I really think there are positive things we can do that will strengthen the sacred settlement law that will make it work well for churches and communities. And so I appreciate that it's being laid over. You have my commitment. We are all continuing to work on it, and I appreciate all the testifiers who come today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Now, members, before we vote on the A3, are there any questions about this specific amendment? Again, this is being laid over, and as you've heard, the author plans to continue to improve the bill with additional amendments. Seeing none, we'll renew Representative Davis's motion. All in favor of the amendment? Aye. Opposed? It has been amended. And is there anything further for the author? Otherwise, we will start with the testifiers.
I'm happy to have the testifiers come.
Okay, Heidi Nelson and Daniel Lightfoot. Please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Kwan. My name is Heidi Nelson. I serve as the City Administrator for the City of Maple Grove. We're here to testify today in support of House File 1051 as amended, which was outlined by Representative Robbins. Just a bit of background about the rental licensing program in Maple Grove and with regard to how the Sacred Settlement legislation would work. Current Sacred Settlement legislation provides no state, county, or local licensing oversight. Similar types of housing, be it group living, homes with services, foster care, et cetera, are licensed by either the state or the county. Providing licensing oversight provides tenants with recourse for complaints if issues concerning the condition of living situation of the living situation arise. What we often find in Maple Grove is the rental licensing issues that we're dealing with are really helping to resolve tenant issues with their landlord in terms of life safety issues in their unit or just the conditions of how the unit is kept. In Maple Grove, rental properties receive a full inspection at the time of licensing and every 3 years thereafter. Items reviewed upon inspection are related to life safety concerns within the unit. The proposed legislation does not allow cities to make special requirements for rental licensing that only pertain to sacred settlements. Sacred settlements must be inspected under the identical guidelines that are used for either single-family homes or multifamily homes. For sacred settlements, areas to be inspected would include the units themselves to make sure they comply with state law, as well as common kitchen and restroom areas, as well as exterior areas that may cause safety concerns, those being sidewalks, parking areas, those types of things. In Maple Grove, as I mentioned, renters will often call the city to make complaints. If the complaints are about the physical issue with the property or the home, the city is able to intervene through the rental licensing process. Without a rental license, there's very little a city can do to address a complaint unless it was something of a criminal nature. Rental licensing is an administrative process in Maple Grove and does not require a public hearing or other formal approval process. If minimum standards are achieved and an inspection is passed, a rental license is provided. That's what I have to share with you with regard to our support of this legislation that would allow for a rental licensing program when a sacred settlement is located in a municipality. And I would stand for any questions.
We're going to proceed through the testifiers, then we'll if you have any questions for them. Daniel Lightfoot. And the next two would be Mickey Elfenbein. I apologize if I didn't pronounce that right. And Lee Patton. You know, and if you're set up on the testifying, if you can sit in the chairs and get ready. Proceed with introducing yourself and your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot with the League of Minnesota Cities. The League represents the collective interests of our 841 member cities across the state of Minnesota, of which, of course, the city of Maple Grove is one. I won't take a whole lot of the committee's time today, mostly here for some technical help, technical questions, if there are any. The League was fairly instrumental in working with many of the advocates that are before you today testifying in the creation of the Sacred Settlement Statute initially, and thus we've also been working with the City of Maple Grove, Representative Robbins, and stakeholders on this amendment. The original legislation did include a reference to Chapter 504B as a requirement for micro-units in settlements as a condition of their existence. It was our understanding that the inclusion of Chapter 504B, which is the landlord-tenant statute, would allow a city to impose rental licensing much like they would for any type of rental building. Because of the construct of the statute itself, it was fairly limiting in terms of anything outside of that statute, which wouldn't be able to be done by a city. And so in working with the city of Maple Grove and advocates, we felt that to go back to sort of the original intent of the statute would be to expressly call out the ability for a city to impose rental licensing standards on units, as Ms. Nelson said, to ensure good outcomes on all settlements, as well as have some level of recourse if there was a tenant complaint to the city or to their housing provider, which is the faith community. That's something that wasn't covered in statute as a life safety issue, could still be reconciled by a city and have some ability for cities to compel a faith community to fix it. Let's say your smoke detector was broken or the steps up to your unit were broken, and if there wasn't a since it wasn't called out specifically in statute as a standard for the unit and the settlement itself, and because the city wouldn't have an ability to impose rental licensing in existing statute, we felt that some clarification was necessary to allow, in a permissive way, a city that had rental licensing standards to also apply that rental licensing standard to settlements while still not going outside of the parameters of the statute for settlements, as long as that life and safety piece was included there. So happy to continue to work on this language with advocates. You're going to hear from some very successful settlements that are already in existence in several cities across the state. And the goal here is just to ensure that all settlements, regardless of where they're created, regardless of which faith community creates them, are set up for success, and that tenants have recourse to work with cities to ensure that their units and the settlement itself maintain the requirements under statute. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And next is Mr. Patton. And if Mr. Campbell can sit down. Mr. Patton.
Mr. Elfenbein.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. The testifier can introduce himself.
Am I next? Yeah, okay. So, Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Mickey Elfenbein. I'm the president of the Chapelwood Homeowner Association and represent the majority of the homeowners in Chapelwood and four other homeowner associations and two of the street homeowner communities. All of these are immediately adjacent to the proposed sacred community in Maple Grove. There's approximately 300 homeowners in this group. And I'm here to support of HF 1051 because it ensures that the development of sacred settlements happens with proper oversight, community involvement, and municipal support, something that hasn't happened so far with the new sacred settlement that's proposed in Maple Grove. I want to be clear, though, supporting innovative housing solutions for those in need is important, but the current law allowing sacred settlements to bypass critical safeguards that exists for a reason. When a new settlement is proposed in our neighborhoods, residents deserve a voice in the process. Right now, local governments and the people most affected have not had their voices heard. HF 1051 corrects this by requiring meaningful community engagement before these settlements are approved. I don't think it makes legitimate reasoning why anyone would object to this unless they want to avoid any realistic oversight or scrutiny. Additionally, cities must be prepared to provide necessary services, emergency response, infrastructure, and social support. Without proper planning and coordination, we risk creating housing that lacks long-term sustainability. HF 1051 ensures that these settlements integrate effectively into our communities rather than being imposed upon them without adequate resources or oversight. So the bill's not about stopping sacred settlements, but making sure they're done right with transparency, accountability, and input from the people who live nearby. I urge you to support HF 1051 to create a fair, thoughtful approach to this important issue. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Patton.
Yes, I am Mr. Patton. Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much for taking the time to hear us today. My name is Leah Patton. I'm the executive director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. So our coalition is made up of four faith community groups in Minnesota. So that would be the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Islamic Center of Minnesota, the Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Minnesota Council of Churches. So those four organizations get together, decide what faith's values we share, and what causes we can advocate for as a multi-faith community at the Capitol. So we were part of a group of advocates, some of which you'll hear today, that brought this bill forward and worked with Representative Hollins and Representative Ann Newbrinley to get this passed a few years ago. So just a little bit of context. When Settled, who you will hear from today, came to us with this model, we were excited to get to advocate alongside them because for us, it was a way that we believe all four of our faith traditions are called to serve our neighbors and housing people that are unhoused and providing a community, which this model provides for people to help recover from trauma, get their feet under them. And we were overjoyed about that. So in that process, we believe that this is a religious freedom issue. So we believe that these community, that churches, mosques, synagogues have a right to practice their faith in this way. However, we also acknowledge that the city has a compelling interest, which is the religious freedom precedent language, a compelling interest to protect the health and safety of residents. So the thinking behind this bill was to establish that health and safety standard preemptively outside of a legal process that would have determined that as well. So there is a permitting process that the cities go through, or that the communities go through with the cities to establish the settlement that was geared towards that. And it was a successful process. I want to acknowledge Dan Lightfoot and the League of Cities and how instrumental, as he said, that they were in establishing that language over about 3 or 4 years that we worked on the bill. That's a kind of a little bit of context. We understand that the cities, with the current language that's in statute, are uncomfortable with the oversight that is provided in the bill with the permitting process, and that they'd like a little bit more clarity on what that oversight can be. We agree that the city definitely has a right. It's one of the most important things that they do to ensure the health and safety of residents. And we appreciate that Representative Robbins and the cities have been more than willing to talk to us and get to some sort of resolution. So we'll continue to talk about this and see if we can find a solution that works for everyone and creates a statewide standard while also ensuring health and safety of residents. So that's all I got.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Next would be Ricky Campbell, Michael Stetzler, and then Meredith Campbell.
All right. Chair Quam, members of the committee, thank you so much for your time today. Grace and peace to you this lovely afternoon. I know you've got a ton of work ahead of you, and so I just recognize that this time is precious. So thank you so much for allowing us to speak. My name is Ricky Campbell. I represent Settled. We're an organization of families, individuals, churches, people who really believe that part of the work of churches, of the local church, of faith communities, is to love and serve and care for the poor. And we do that through a few ways. We're kind of known as the tiny home people. We equip churches to pay for and build tiny homes that are up to a standard, up to a code that this body agreed upon 2 years ago in statute. We also equip churches, local churches, to establish what we call sacred settlements. The law recognizes them as sacred communities. And what the law allows for, what our model shows, is that 2/3 of these homes are for people who've experienced chronic homelessness. These are permanent homes for people who've experienced chronic homelessness. They're low barrier. People have to pay rent, and they have to follow the law. The other 1/3 of the permanent homes are for what the law calls designated volunteers. We call them intentional neighbors. And these are people just like you or me who are resourced and probably never experienced homelessness, and they have a desire to live intentionally in a community alongside other folks and their heart behind it is simply to be a good neighbor. The church or mosque or the law allows that these worship centers are an extension of these tiny homes. So that's where there are shared meals. That's where there's shared cooking. That's where there's movie nights and things like that. And so the worship center acts as an extension of that tiny home. This model provides another way for faith communities to live out their calling. It also gives them an opportunity to tap into some of our society's, our shared concerns around homelessness. We all have a job. We all have a role to play in that. And this is just another way that faith communities can execute this mission. You'll soon hear stories from two different of these communities, also the people who call them home and the people who invest their lives into this model. So in 2023, this body brought together Republicans and Democrats. They brought together industry and the cities, as you've already heard before, advocates, to come together with the sacred communities law. And there was a lot put in there, a lot of effort that you've already heard about. And what we've come up with is an incredible law that allows, that recognizes the faith community's right to carry this out. And I would say that this bill before you today that Representative Robbins has brought for as amended, it's been amended to help clarify a lot of what was set out years ago. It's been amended to address many of the concerns that we've had. It's been amended to address a lot of the concerns that other stakeholders have. And so we are continuing in that conversation, and we are committed to continuing that conversation. I would say one of the biggest parts for us we just have a concern with is this rental licensing program. The reason for that being is that currently under the law, these faith communities use a conditional use permit to get approved through the city. The concerns about landlord-tenant stuff that is also outlined in state statute 504B185, I'll point you to, but we're willing to, point to that a little bit more effectively. I think the thing with rental licensing programs, while they give municipalities a great opportunity to get their arms around rental properties in their locality, they have historically also been used to discriminate against affordable housing and places that are trying to do work similar to this. I'm not saying in any way whatsoever that that is the intention of either the author or the city of Maple Grove, but there is a historical precedence where that has been a concern, and so that is just a concern of ours. Again, we will continue working with the author. We'll continue working with all the folks who are here at the table. We've had really good conversations, and I really like the way that this is being very collaborative. And so I would just leave you to say that the statute that was set out, that this body agreed to 2 years ago, is really good for Minnesota. It's something that Minnesotans should be really proud of. And I think as we continue to work through this and see more and more sacred communities come to fruition, that this is something that we can really share pride in, both in the public sector, private and nonprofit sectors. So thank you.
And thank you. Next is Stetzler, then Campbell. Thank you. Introduce yourself and proceed.
I'm Michael Stetzler. I'm the former president of the Congregation Council of Prince of Peace Lutheran Church in Roseville. We're the church up on the hill overlooking Central Park. For those of you that don't know, drive by sometime. We're on Victoria and County C. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. First of all, I want to echo everything that Ricky said about the legislation. We are so grateful that this legislature passed the statute that enabled us to continue forward in this mission that we were called to. A little history. I was the president of the congregation back when the pandemic was at its roar. And a lot of things happened in our congregation, and we went through a lot of soul searching. I did a lot of work on trying to reframe our mission, vision, and values. And guess what? We got a long way down that road, and then all of a sudden, Valerie came along. And for those of you that are unfamiliar, Valerie is the person who was homeless who came to our property in a bus, and that led to her staying, and that led to Settled graciously offering us a tiny home to house her, and we went through that whole process and had a lot of trouble figuring out how to do that within the constraints of legislation and regulation. But it worked, and the legislation passed. And where we are now, I'm really happy to say, is that we are a thriving community of only three houses, one intentional neighbor family, and two neighbors. But before I go further, I just want to say that our mission is building the church and loving the world. And we have some values in there. One of the primary ones is relationship. And what we have found is that in the past, where we would think of building the church, oh, well, that's getting more members, that's bringing people into our doors. Loving the world, oh, well, that's building a food shelf, that's going out and doing backpacks for kids in school, that's giving to our missions and so forth. But it's kind of hard to combine the two. How do you love the world 1 hour a week on Sunday? And we just got called into this backwards. God just called us in and said, hey, you know, got an idea for you. And what we have found leads me to say that I need to correct a kind of a misunderstanding or a misframing of this whole thing. This isn't a housing program, from our point of view. This isn't a program to help the homeless, from our point of view. This is a program to build the church and love the world. The primary benefit to us is transforming us as a church. We are not doing for people who are coming out of homeless. We are living in community with people who are homeless. And as you consider the tweaks to the legislation, and I think it's a really great idea that you're doing that, and I really support your work, Representative, I just want to say that you got to think about the differences here. These people are not our tenants. These people are part of our family. When you're thinking about regulating that tenancy, it's probably more appropriate to think of it in like one of our close relatives had some economic bad times and they had to come and live with us. They're part of our family. Now, just how would you regulate that? We share our home with the people coming out of homelessness. They cook, they play, they work in our building. And we don't just have contact with them on Sunday morning. We live in community with them. When the senior group meets on Thursdays, they pass these people in the hall. They go out and they work in the garden with them. You know, it's one family situation. So please, please change your mind frame from traditional tenant-landlord relationship and traditional government regulation of things that you don't want bad people to get away with to this is a family. And thank you for your time.
Meredith Campbell and Laura Smith. And Laura, you can sit in the empty chair if you wish to. Please proceed with your introduction and your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Meredith Campbell, and I lead Sacred Settlement Mosaic, a permanent, intentional, tiny home community. Mosaic Christian Community is a church of the Nazarene on the east side of St. Paul, and our mission is to mobilize and equip the community of Christ into a lifestyle of hospitality. And our Sacred Settlement has six tiny homes. Four of those homes are for neighbors who have experienced chronic homelessness. And two of those homes are for intentional neighbors, as you heard, people who have not experienced homelessness, who are resourced, who choose to move into the neighborhood to be that support, that friend. Our community is described as peaceful, and it is. We have family dinners, we play games, we sing, we celebrate birthdays and holidays together, not just those living in the community, but the broader supportive friend network who comes alongside us. And Mosaic loves our East Side neighborhood and have built wonderful relationships. We want it to be a safe and flourishing place. Our Sacred Settlement shares a garden with our Karen neighbors. We have block parties, neighborhood kids trick-or-treat throughout the settlement. My kids run around with other neighborhood kids on the lawn and go sledding through the community in the winter. And I often get questions from people around the country about how do we operate? Like, it sounds great, but how does this work? How do you operate? We first get our authority to operate from our calling by God, who has called us to love our neighbors and to care for and to serve the poor and the vulnerable among us. Second, we get our ability to operate under the Religious Land Use Act, and you have some memos in your packets just about that. But third, here in Minnesota, we have Minnesota Statute 327.30. That's the law that is in question right now that we're looking at refining. And that recognizes the ability of faith communities to operate these settlements when homes are built to a certain standard, when they are offered to certain people, and when they are housed on certain land. That's that religious land. And when you read the law, you'll see that the city can permit us as a permitted use or as a conditional use. And that's where that public input comes into play. There's conditional use permits have a hearing process. That's where the neighborhood comes and talks about it. And of course, the city's put this on their agenda to come have neighborhood input involvement. The church wants to do this in collaboration with the city. The point of the bill was to recognize this at a state level. So we didn't have to go like city by city and piece together some patchwork. What does it look like in this city? What does it look like in this city? How does it work here? But to say we have a standard, we have a statewide standard that works. As you heard from Mr. Stetzler, you know, this isn't traditional housing. It is something different. And this law recognizes that it's something different, and it should be regulated and given the authority to operate as something different. I just want to show you, here's the binder that we submit to the city. And in it, we show, this is what Mosaic submitted, this is what Prince of Peace submitted, and it shows how we meet the requirements of the law. Because again, we love our city. We want to be in compliance. We want to do a good thing here. So it has things in here like our contact person, our insurance, inspections of the home by NOAA. That's the National Organization of Alternative Tiny Homes. It has our emergency plan in there. And this is what we give to the city because we want them to know that we're here, that we're operating, and that we're meeting the requirements of the law. And under current law, we're also subject to landlord-tenant law. And this is the handbook. And you know, you've seen it in the bill. That's that 504B. And this is a landlord's guide to Minnesota law. And it covers things like what a lease needs to look like, what an eviction process looks like, how to perform necessary maintenance, how to collect rent, tenants' right, including the right of tenants to ask for inspections. So what a tenant can do under 504B, as I understand it, is that they can make a request to the city and say, you know, there's whatever the complaint is, and then the city can inspect it. I understand that this bill has come a long way, and I really appreciate Representative Robbins for working on the language. And I do understand that this is new, and there might be some clarifying changes that need to be made to the law so that we all really have a good understanding of what the roles are. Any rental licensing requirements, though however narrowly tailored, are unnecessary. At best, I believe that it's an additional unnecessary government regulation on a faith community. And at worst, I think it really could be used to intimidate or to delay faith communities from implementing these communities. Again, I'm not saying that's the intention, but that could be the result. I'm not quite sure the language of the amendment in front of you, but even if the language were to put us in the category of, say, a single-family rental property, we don't even meet those requirements. We're a tiny home. We don't look like a single-family unit, so we're not going to meet, you know, those certain standards. The idea is that we have something different, and it is that 327.30 statute and the building requirements that are in there. So on the east side, we've seen our relationship with our east side neighbors flourish. We've had people come to the church and start attending because they are interested in what we are doing. We have had neighbors of no faith and of different faiths stop by and introduce themselves, eager to learn more about the good work that's going on. We have had people move into the neighborhood because they have heard about the sacred settlement, because they have wanted to get involved, and because they wanted to live near it. And this is good work. It's good work happening in us, in our families, and in our neighbors who came off the streets and have a place to call home. So I would just ask that you let us continue it without any unnecessary burdens or government interference. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next testifier is Laura Smith. Would David Doran and Mark McNeely please come up to the testifiers? Ms. Smith, please proceed, introduce yourself, and testify.
Good afternoon, Chair and committees. I'm Laura, and I'm here today because the past 2 years I have gained friends and family through Sacred Settlement Mosaic. The homes, they are tiny, but they also come with other humans who have big hearts. They also come with tiny humans, kids, like short people. They rock out loud. I mean, not that midgets are bad, but I just wanted to clarify. The kids and stuff who I get to see all the time, who I get to play with, eat with, blow bubbles with, the whole community's just been phenomenal. We have movie nights, we host block parties, and hand out candy on Halloween. We also all dress the same, which is real fun. We were Legos last Halloween. We try to be good neighbors together and to the neighborhood around us. It's not easy for me to be here today talking to all of you, but you're very welcoming, and I appreciate that. I believe this model is worth speaking about because it's not just the church. It's about the human being. It's about humans being able to learn to live together. Thank you for this opportunity. And I thank them for the opportunity of living there. I have been chronically homeless for a while, and I can go to my neighbor and borrow them a cup of sugar. I mean, I know they didn't ask, but it is such a close community. And though things may not be written in laws and such, I know if I have any issue with, you know, fire alarms or any of that jazz, they have always been go above and beyond to make sure things are taken care of. And I appreciate this opportunity for you guys to let me speak. And Mosaic rocks out loud. So does Prince of Peace, though. We get to visit them a lot, and I'm going to try to stop talking now. Okay. Thank you again.
And thank you. David, if you can introduce yourself and start your testimony.
Yeah, I'm David Doran. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I live at Sacred Settlement Mosaic also. Before moving in 2 years ago, I lived in the woods. I was put out after my brother lost his housing that I was sharing with him. But now I'm finding stability again at Mosaic and with people who are getting to know me. I went from guarding all my food to being a cook who gets to help host dinners and barbecues. And I went from getting my stuff stolen from a tent in the woods to gaining security in a home where my door locks and I can rest easy. I went from constantly looking over my shoulder in fears of being mugged to seeing people every day who care for me and some who even give me hugs. Now I'm giving back. I was recently elected to the governing board of Heading Home Ramsey, which is Ramsey County's continuum of care. I bring my experience, knowledge, and resources to help county officials, local nonprofits, and other community leaders address homelessness right in our backyard. All of us want safety and security. We all want to live meaningful lives. Sacred Settlement Mosaic and the Sacred Communities Law provides ways for all of that to happen. Thank you for your time.
And thank you very much. Mr. McNeely. Thank you.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. My name is Mark, but I go by Junior. I have lived in the Sacred Settlement at Mosaic for more than 2 years. What is it? It's a tiny home community church on the land of the east side of St. Paul. I spent about 10 years living in the streets in the woods. Living out there, you're always in survival mode. You're always worrying about food and safety. I was also worrying about my partner, Chrissy. Now I have four walls, a locked door, I can relax. I can be fully present, and I can be myself. My life and my health has improved dramatically. Sorry. The sacred settlement promotes dignity, respect, and requires responsibility. I have to pay rent, and I get to be part of the community with other people who are taking care of each other. At Mosaic, there are always families around the people going out of their way to support me, encouraging me and me not to judge me. The community is supporting and encouraging each other. That is what the model is all about. Now I've been at Mosaic, I had more opportunities for work reasons to better me as a person, getting physical and mental health opportunities to appointments, and my family has grown. The people that live in the community and people who are invested in are now my family. One day I want to write a book about all of it. Thank you for hearing my story.
Thank you very much, and thank you to all of the testifiers and to the public. This is because some legislation made it possible to help these people. And the bill before us is to try and improve that legislation. We did pass the amendment. Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I want to just take a moment and thank all the advocates who are here today to speak on this. And Representative Robbins, I take you at your word that you are legitimately focused on allowing faith communities to live out their faith in the way that they want to. And I couldn't help but reflect on the fact that a week ago yesterday when I was at church, the scripture lesson was the Good Samaritan. And it's been a few years since I've been a Sunday school teacher, and certainly don't want to step on Reverend Davis's toes here, but one of the things that I always appreciated about teaching that story is having a conversation about how politically difficult that story would have been when it was first told. And so I just couldn't help but sort of think of the parallels there. But just a few questions here, and I'm specifically, the first one I'm looking at lines 3.6 and 3.7, and I'm wondering, the phrase rental housing licensing program, it's just kind of a curious phrase to me. I'm wondering if you could just explain a little bit. I guess my question is, I mean, is this just a sort of rental housing license infrastructure the way it's normally set up at the local level, or is this something different?
To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Coulter. So the idea as it is, and let me just be clear, evolving, is that so the conditional use permit just wasn't sufficient because, to the testifier's point, if something went wrong and they called the city has no authority without a license to go investigate. They get a complaint, but they literally had no jurisdiction under just the current drafting. And so the idea that we're working through is to come up with a type of licensing that strictly lists, and I can, the amendment as of this morning, let me see where I put it, that we're working through right now is that it would say, the micro unit in a sacred community cannot be regulated beyond those contained in Minnesota Statutes 504 or in the Sacred Settlement Statute. So it would be either a new, like, sacred settlement license, or it would be an amendment to a city ordinance that just covered sacred settlements, and it would be limited to what's protected in 504 for landlord-tenant law, which, you know, she showed you the book. Like, those are real things. It's just that under the current construction, the only way to enforce that is for the person in the sacred settlement to go file a lawsuit. And that's just not, I think, what was even intended or practical. So this would, so we're still, as I said, even like as of an hour ago, wordsmithing how it'll be. But the intention is that there'd be some licensing, but limited to 504.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. That's extremely helpful. So it sounds like the answer to the question I asked is more or less yes, that it would not be sort of a, what we would consider a traditional rental license such as would exist for other rental.
Right. Well, and that's where
I'm
sorry, Mr. Chair.
The author.
Mr. Chair and Representative Coulter. So, right, the amendment we did adopt was more specific, and it said it couldn't be a rental license more restrictive than those already imposed by rental single-family residences and rental multifamily residences. But as we've worked through that, the advocates have continued to express concern that that's broader than necessary. So that's why we're working on shaving that down to just 504. So I do think that's where we'll net out, but we're not there yet.
And members, this is being laid over. As it's obvious, we've got a very broad group of people working towards peace in the valley, and everybody, really cares about making this assistance the best thing it can be. Did you have an additional question?
Yeah, just a couple more. And thank you. That's helpful, and I think that does help me. As somebody who spent 5 years on a city council, going through these kinds of approvals, that's helpful to understand kind of what the vision is for what this looks like. And so I guess I'm going to have to sort of shift a little bit how I was going to ask this other question, because, you know, usually when we're talking about rental housing, new rental housing that's being built, there may be, you know, rezoning and all of that related to the development itself. But, you know, rental licenses, and I think your city administrator mentioned it, are administrative processes. There's usually not, for a rental license, a public hearing or anything like that. Am I correct in understanding, at least is the way understanding, of course, that things can and will change, which I personally think is a good thing about the legislative process, it sounds like that the way the bill is written right now, that would be the case, that this would be largely an administrative process for approval that wouldn't have, say, a public hearing at a planning commission or city council or something like that.
To the author.
So my understanding is that the way it's constructed and potentially will stay constructed is that they can have the sacred, it's under the sacred settlement law and the option for this conditional or this rental license pertaining to 504. So if a city went the conditional use permit, then I think all those public notifying things happen. But I guess that's something I would personally want to look at if we do the sacred settlement licensing, is that there would still be an avenue for public input. Because I think that's really critical to the success of the community, that there's communication with the neighbors, with the city, and that's one of the places where, as you heard from the homeowner in my community, the people who reached out to me in Maple Grove is this sense like there hasn't been enough engagement, and it's caused, you know, division, which has been difficult in our community. So this is an attempt to try to address that. So I personally would want to continue to find a way for that public engagement part of the process.
And by 2:00, this will be laid over. So,
well, okay.
Representative Colt, I mean, this bill is being laid over so you can have the discussions. The amendment is being in the process of being drafted. So that's, you go ahead, Representative Coulter.
Yeah.
At 2:00, I will lay this over.
You can come back tonight, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cohen, if you do not have another question, Representative Lee.
I wasn't finished, Mr. Chair.
Well, then actually ask a question.
I was waiting to be recognized by the chair of the committee to do that.
Representative Calder, go ahead.
Mr. Lightfoot, it looked like he was jumping out of his chair a little bit, so I wonder if he wanted to offer some clarification.
Mr. Chair, Representative, very, very quickly,
Mr. Lightfoot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Coulter, very quickly, the language here wouldn't preclude the conditional use permit process. So think of the permitted use or the conditional use permit process as sort of the green light to do the establishment of the settlement. The rental licensing piece of this is sort of the ongoing enforcement mechanism to make sure that the settlement is complying with all areas and parameters outlined in the statute, as well as any potential life safety issues that could arise either from a tenant complaint or a subsequent inspection through that process. It's generally referred to as a rental licensing program because they are ordinances that adopt sort of the parameters of the rental license itself in individual cities. But the crux of those is the life safety piece. The challenge here was the language in 327 was very constricted to the provisions in the statute itself, which attorneys read that precluded the ability of a city to have that sort of ongoing enforcement mechanism for life safety because it wasn't specifically spelled out in the bill.
Thank you. That's helpful. And my other question was about that interaction.
Representative
Calder. Oh, I'm sorry, Chair. My other question was about that interaction between the rental license and the CUP process. So that was helpful. So I think I'm done, Mr. Chair.
Representative Freiberg. I wanted to give you enough time to be able to do your statement.
Mr. Chair, I understand other members of my committee were on the list to be spoken, and I'm fine being last as kind of the closer, as the lead on the committee. So if you could call on them first, I'd appreciate it.
There are about 3.5 minutes left. So, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I will try to be quick. I guess the most important piece is I just want to go back to the author's opening statements and just I think like the discussion that we've had here suggests that, you know, there's a little bit more work to be done with the bill, and also just teasing out things of the bill that passed last year. Thanks to Rep Hollins, who's in the audience with us today. Thank you to my co-Eastsider legislator. But I wanted to draw members' attention to page 3, subdivision 8, about the injunction piece. I know the author mentioned that, you know, she wants these settlements to continue going, but, you know, reading this section and being a pretend lawyer, you know, my question is, you know, why is this section in here when, you know, cities and municipalities already have the option to, you know, bring about injunctions if they want to of settlements? To me, this section looks like you're venue court trapping, and so we'd just like some clarity on that. But it looks like Mr. Lightfoot maybe has an answer. So,
Mr. Lightfoot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, yeah, thank you for the question. The injunction piece is generally the remedy for a city doing an enforcement action on a landlord or a housing provider that is unwilling to make the fix if it's a life safety issue. We're still having conversations about this piece in particular because, to your point, it may or may not be necessary in this piece. But traditionally, in a rental licensing situation, if the housing provider is unwilling to make the change after being compelled by the city, for example, if a tenant requests the change to the city or to their housing provider, they don't do it. City says, "Hey, here's a work order. You got to fix this." The housing provider says, "Go pound sand." Then there is a level of legal action that can be taken. That said, it may or may not be needed in this case. We're still working on that.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And so, I mean, my question is, I know, again, this bill is being laid over. I wonder if this piece stays, maybe this bill also has to go to judiciary, and just curious about, you know, how we're constructing.
Once an amendment is visible, then we'll be able to determine if it has to go to other committees. And that's part of the reason why a lot of our questions probably would be well-timed once the amendment is, you know, fully visible and for us. And it just didn't make it in time for a committee for us to be able to have a draft and look at it. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you. Just a quick question before you call on my other members. You know, this is the committee of jurisdiction for this bill. Like, we have all the stakeholders here in the room to discuss it right now as we speak, so this seems like the appropriate time for our members to be asking questions. We don't know what form it might come back in. We don't know whether the stakeholders will be available at that point, so I think we should take this opportunity to fully discuss this bill. If we if we have to come back tonight, I'm fine with that. I know the bill that's next on the agenda was also laid over to the evening last time, so we're all prepared to do that. So I'd appreciate it if you would go through the list and call on the other members on my side.
Representative Freiberg, we do not even have the exact language of the amendment, so therefore it's going to have to be laid over no matter what. So it being time, the bill is now laid over.
Thank
you.
Mr. Chair,
ask for a roll call vote.
Next will be...
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee stand in recess, and I ask for a roll call.
Okay, roll call. Whether we're going to be in recess or not.
Chair Quam.
No.
Vice Chair Altendorf.
No.
Representative Acorn.
Yes.
Representative Coulter.
Aye.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Gordon.
No.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Yes.
Representative McDonald.
No.
Representative Roach.
No.
Representative Vernig.
Yes.
Six nays, five ayes.
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee adjourn and I request a roll call.
Let's take a roll call.
Chair Quam.
Yet.
Vice Chair Altendorf.
No.
Representative Acorn.
Yes.
Representative Coulter.
Aye.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Gordon.
No.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Representative Lee.
Yes.
Representative McDonald.
No.
Representative Roach.
No.
Representative Vernig.
Yes.
Six nays, five ayes.
Mr. Chair, I ask that the minutes reflect the objection on my side to the fact that we were not given an opportunity for all members to ask questions and that the debate was arbitrarily cut short.
And Representative Freiberg, the minutes will also represent that the amendment was not ready for the committee and the bill was going to be laid over no matter what, and that until the language of the amendment is actually available for the committee, we couldn't proceed farther. But would the author of the next bill please come to the testifier's table? And with that, I move that House File 16 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. And the author has a three-line A1 amendment to get it to form of the author's, the form that which the author prefers. And I would move the A1 amendment for inclusion. Author to explain the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for having me in today. I'm offering an amendment on House File 16, which, let me get the language exactly right here, but it essentially redefines what we're considering to be violent crime in this bill to just better define and better clarify what actually constitutes violent crime in the spirit of this bill. So the amendment is page 3, line 23, the deletion of crime of violence as defined in section 624 712 subdivision 5 and instead insert violent crime as defined by 611A 036 subdivision 7.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a quick question because I heard this bill in public safety already, and I think it's part of the, it's probably in response to that discussion. I'm wondering if this amendment incorporates the question of whether the crimes of violence just apply to Section 3 or whether it applies to Section 1 and Section 2 as well.
Would the author prefer the nonpartisan staff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be appreciated.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment before you only amends Section 3 of the bill and does not apply to the first two sections of the bill.
So do you?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Davis.
I could not hear.
He said it only applies to Section 3. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, and this is just a clarification because I also had a hard time hearing you. It only applies to Section 3, so that means this language listing the crimes of violence as modified by this amendment does not apply to Section 1 or Section 2 in this bill. Is that right? Did I hear you say that?
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. It only amends Section 3 of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, I ask for a roll call on the amendment. Take the roll.
We had a question.
Take the roll.
We have some more questions.
Mr. Chair, we have some more questions on the amendment. I think that's definitely appropriate. Before
there wasn't a hand that came up before it was called for a roll.
Had her hand up.
Okay. Take the roll.
Mr. Chair, she literally had her hand up since I've been talking.
She can ask the question after we take
after
the vote.
So we're supposed to understand the amendment after we're supposed to vote on the amendment and then ask questions to enable us to understand it,
take
Mr. Chair?
Take the roll. I don't think anyone's been recognized.
Chair Quam?
Yes.
Vice Chair Altendorf?
Pass.
Representative Acom?
Pass.
What did she
pass. Just continue.
Representative Coulter?
Pass.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Gordon?
Yes.
Representative Greenman?
Pass.
Representative Lee?
Pass.
Representative McDonald?
Aye.
Representative Roach?
Yes.
Representative Vernig?
Pass.
Well, since a majority of the committee voted for it, the amendment passes. Let us proceed with the testifiers, and we will be voting on this at 2:40.
Mr. Chair, is there any possibility
David,
of us coming back tonight?
Zimmerman, please proceed to the testifier table. The next one would be Mary Niedermeyer. Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is David Zimmer. I'm the Public Safety Policy Fellow with Center of the American Experiment. I appear today in support of House File 16, which addresses two common sense measures. First, preventing state and local government from creating law or policy that would prohibit sharing information about unauthorized immigrants with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. And number two, ensuring that law enforcement share information with ICE about criminal offenders arrested for crimes of violence. We know that measures such as these have broad public support. In 2024, an American Experiment poll showed that 59% of Minnesotans polled opposed last year's DFL-led effort to introduce sanctuary state legislation. And in January 2025, an AP NORC poll showed that 83% of American adults favored the deportation of unauthorized immigrants who had been convicted of violent crime. It's also important to know that House File 16 aligns well with current federal law, which states no state or local government entity may be prohibited or in any other way restricted from sending to or receiving from ICE information regarding the immigration status, lawful or unlawful, of an alien in the United States. As a bit of background, I retired 3 years ago from local law enforcement. During my career, I served in several leadership capacities that involved cooperating with ICE, including as the captain of the Hennepin County Jail. I saw firsthand during my career the importance of interagency cooperation with all of our federal partners, including ICE. Last year, during the debate surrounding the North Star bill, I became concerned with some of the narratives being used that didn't fit with the reality that I knew. I'd like to address House File 16 in the lens of these narratives. The idea that cooperating with ICE is a waste of finite time and resources for law enforcement simply falls flat. A core tenet of law enforcement is that officers and agencies help each other when needed. This spirit of cooperation runs both ways, and it serves as the foundation of the law enforcement community, which depends on force multipliers to properly address public safety issues. Throughout my career, I personally worked with the FBI, the ATF, the DEA, the Secret Service, the U.S. Postal Inspector, the U.S. Marshals Service, the Department of Defense, the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Energy, the IRS, the U.S. Navy Dive Team. The list goes on, and it includes ICE. And today, officers continue to routinely partner with federal authorities on a variety of matters. It's completely appropriate for law enforcement to collect as much biographical data as they can on those that they detain. It would be inappropriate for an officer not to attempt to determine the country of origin or nationality of a potential unauthorized immigrant that they were dealing with. This information facilitates several things, including mandated foreign consulate notification, checking on the existence of outstate or international warrants, checking on the existence of terrorism watch list notifications, and assisting with future follow-up or attempts to locate that individual. It's important to note that our data practices statutes, which govern law enforcement data, already mandate the sharing of that information in many instances and allow for it in others. To suggest that we should create firewalls or carve out an exception to the sharing of this data with ICE is an uncalled for obstruction of an appropriate law enforcement process. House File 16 would also help to address a problem created by ICE detainers. Due to the massive volume of unauthorized immigrants ICE is responsible for, ICE tends to rely almost solely on the civil detainer and deportation process rather than the more time-consuming criminal prosecution process. But the civil process doesn't mesh well with the detention timelines that govern local law enforcement. This dilemma would be eliminated by more timely and appropriate sharing of information with ICE, like we do with almost every other federal partner. Absent this timely notification, ICE is frequently unable to take custody of individuals at the time their local holds expire. ICE is then put in the unnecessary and dangerous position of having to either stand outside of the jail or the courthouse or going out into the community to rearrest people who had just been in custody. These situations often result in the unintended detention and deportation of undocumented individuals who would not have come in the, who would not have come to the attention of ICE had ICE not had to go into the community to arrest people previously detained. If the argument is that immigration is a federal matter, and if, as many officials have stated, they don't want to obstruct or prevent ICE from doing their job, then we need to ensure that information is shared with ICE at the earliest stages of detention. This will ensure ICE has an appropriate amount of time to do its job so it can focus on public safety threats and reduce unintended consequences. Finally, I'd like to address the narrative that cooperation between local authorities and ICE has a chilling effect on the willingness of immigrants to cooperate with local police or report crime. This narrative is not borne out by the facts. It is not my experience in over 20 years as a criminal investigator, and the Center for Immigration Studies looked at the issue in 2021 and concluded, quote, "We find no evidence in the National Crime Victimization Survey data to support that a chilling effect theory that immigrants are more reluctant to report crime generally or in the parts of the country where local authorities routinely cooperate with ICE." I thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'm sorry for my raspy voice, and I urge you to vote yes on House File 16.
Thank you, Chair Quam and members of the committee. My name is Mary Niedermeyer, and I'm the CEO of CAPI. I am speaking today as a member organization of the North Star Alliance. The Alliance includes dozens of community-based and faith-based social justice organizations who believe in the dignity of every human being. We strongly oppose House File 16. We believe that it would erode local control of limited government resources. Many cities and police departments have decided to focus on local issues versus directing their resources towards federal priorities such as immigration enforcement. Although some city and department decisions might be based off of their own politics, others simply do not have the resources or capacity to work alongside federal ICE officers while also responding to ongoing safety issues and existing crime in the community. Although I imagine that the intent of this bill may have been to keep residents safe, it will in fact do the opposite. This bill will harm public safety by eroding trust between local and state government agencies and immigrant communities. If residents fear that a local official will report them to immigration authorities, they are less likely to leave their home and participate in the local economy. They are also less likely to obtain needed services, seek protection from violence, or serve as witnesses in the judicial system. Furthermore, this bill does not only impact undocumented immigrants, but it also impacts those who have built their lives here with their children and have spent thousands of dollars to establish their proper legal status in the U.S. This bill would continue to spread fear and would reverse the many years that police departments have invested in building trust within the community. I urge you to re-examine the harmful impacts this bill will have on the state of Minnesota and to reject House File 16. Thank you.
Thank you. And Kevin, and when you introduce yourself, then I can hear exactly how I'm supposed to pronounce your last name. Sorry about that. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Kevin Nguyen. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin. I'm an organizer with Minnesota 8. I'm here as a child of immigrants and refugees. My dad was separated from his own family during the Vietnam War. On his own, he left everything in pursuit of a better life, far from war and violence. He's escaped by boat with the uncertainty of where it will take him. He sought asylum in a land where he did not speak the language. Though resilience, that trauma of being displaced lives on today. With that, I am here to express my strong opposition to House File 16. HF 16 furthers a false narrative around immigrants that divides the community and dehumanizes people who want to live with safety and dignity. This rhetoric is dangerous and fuels policies that strip away those human rights. To understand the harmful impact of this bill, we must understand the stories of immigrants and refugees, many of those who cannot be in this room today because they are living with fear. Minnesota is home to one of the largest Southeast Asian refugee populations. During the Vietnam War, the U.S. dropped more than 2 million tons of bombs and waged illegal warfare in Laos and Cambodia. This war caused the mass displacement of over 1.2 million Southeast Asian refugees, such as my parents. We are here because our homelands were bombed, destroyed, and destabilized. Immigrants have been forcefully displaced from their homes and separated from their families, and some never even unite with their families. The systems of detention, deportation, family separation, and displacement repeats the violence of removing an individual from their family and home. Since January, there has been an increase of people who have come to us because their loved ones were detained, and even more has asked for support in being in fear of being next. Now we have to choose, we have a choice to choose safety for all residents of Minnesota, not just U.S. citizens. Supporters of this bill reinforce the narrative that immigrants are disposable. This bill will make the state employees take on a role they did not sign up for. This would help the federal government continue to chip away at our state's autonomy to make decisions for our own communities. Last week, it was clear where Minnesotans stand. There was overwhelming opposition to the bill. I urge the committee to reject HF 16 and work on policies that center our shared humanity and protect all Minnesotans. Thank you.
And thank you. David Campagna, and then Anna Acosta. And please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Kwan and committee members. My name is David Campana. I am at the Legislative and Policy Director in Economic Development for the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. The Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs is a state agency that advises and informs the legislature and the government on issues relevant to our diverse Latinx communities. The Council expressed its opposition to House File 16. This proposal is detrimental to our constituents and counterproductive to public safety, undermining the trust between local authorities and immigrant communities, and potentially compromising the important contributions of the immigrant population, regardless of immigration status, to our state. Prohibiting non-cooperation policies put immigrants at risk of detention, deportation, and family separation, harming not only the individuals affected, but also the safety and well-being of the community as a whole. A recent report by the Minnesota Chamber Foundation has found that, quote, nearly 60% of the state's total labor force and employment growth came from foreign-born workers from 2019 to 2023, and that Minnesota's foreign-born population is becoming more highly educated, skilled, and entrepreneurial, which could spur future innovation and productivity, unquote. By potentially compromising the safety of the immigrant population, the proposed legislation will also have a negative impact to the Minnesota economy. Being an immigrant myself, I am proud of the contributions of immigrants, both documented and undocumented, to the prosperity of our state. Immigration non-cooperation policies that create a separation between local official work and federal immigration enforcement contribute to the public safety and well-being for all Minnesotans, regardless of immigration status. For these reasons, the Council opposes House File 16 and asks the members of this committee to vote against it. Thank you.
Thank you. Anna? And the last testifier on the list is Mr. Carcamano. And I know I'm having, it's, or is it Josie?
Jose.
Jose.
He was unable to be able to attend
your issue. May I testify on his behalf? I will allow that. Proceed to the desk. Testifier, please proceed. Introduce yourself.
Yes. Good afternoon, Chairman Guam and members of the committee. My name is Anna Patratz Acosta, and I am a professor of law at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, where I specialize in the areas of immigration law, immigration status as a social determinant of health, and public benefits for non-citizens. And I'm offering my testimony today in my professional capacity. Since my time today is limited, I would refer this committee to my written testimony that I presented ahead of this hearing today, and I would like to use my time to highlight the broad scope of House File 16 as written to further underscore my opposition to the bill. So, first of all, while the sponsors and supporters of House File 16 have framed this bill as a common sense and narrowly tailored measure to facilitate cooperation between local prosecutors and local law enforcement with federal civil immigration enforcement, namely ICE, a plain reading of the bill clearly reveals that this is not the case. So specifically, Section 1 of House File 16 seeks to amend Section 13.021 of the Minnesota Data Practices Act to require all government entities and authorities in Minnesota to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement and comply with requests for information and data made in connection with federal immigration enforcement. Additionally, in looking at the proposed amendments in Section 2 to House File 16, they confirm the broad and sweeping nature of this bill and the applicability to all government entities at the state, county, and municipal levels. Specifically, House File 16's proposed amendments to Minnesota Statute Section 299A.82 adopt the definition of the terms government entity and political subdivision that are contained in Minnesota Statute 13.02 at Subdivision 7A and 11, which specifically define government entity as a state agency, statewide system, or political subdivision, and political subdivision as any county, statutory, home charter, or home rule charter city, school district, special district, or any town, which really underscore the broad nature of this bill. In practice, the language makes clear that House File 16 and the requirement that government entities and political subdivisions cooperate with federal immigration enforcement, that this would not be limited to law enforcement agencies, but instead would be a requirement that's imposed on virtually all state and local operations within the state of Minnesota. Additionally, in our current environment, it's important to understand that requests for information or data being made by federal immigration agencies to non-law enforcement agencies, so for example, the state agency, the Minnesota Department of Human Services, are not speculative, and the odds of this happening are actually quite high in our current enforcement environment. To give an example as to why this is the case, there are recent reports that the Department of Homeland Security has requested that a fellow federal agency, the Internal Revenue Service, provide data on undocumented immigrants without a Social Security number who pay their taxes using an ITIN number. In light of this and other efforts by the federal government to ramp up immigration enforcement, it is therefore likely that should House File 16 pass in its current version, it would likely result in state and local entities being required to provide data in response to requests by federal immigration enforcement.
Additionally, I want to highlight again that House File 16 does appear to directly conflict with existing federal law, namely HIPAA and FERPA, which are data privacy protection laws. And then finally, I want to refer you to my testimony to just sort of underscore that House File 16 is likely to result in a chilling effect, not only in immigrants being unwilling to cooperate with local law enforcement investigations, but also result in chronic absenteeism from school if parents are concerned about taking their children to school and being subject to immigration enforcement, and also not affording themselves access to certain services, resulting in adverse health outcomes, resulting from food insecurity and other issues connected to social determinants of health. For these reasons and the other reasons set forth in my written testimony, I strongly oppose House File 16. Thank you.
Thank you for clarifying the obvious that we should follow federal law. The final testifier.
Dear Chairman Quam and members of the committee, my name is Alyssa Pollard, and I'm a certified student attorney who had the honor of representing Ms. Lillian Carcamo last semester. Her son Josue Galvez Carcamo was going to testify today, and thank you for letting me speak on his behalf. My name is Lillian Carcamo. I live in Coon Rapids, Minnesota. I fled abuse in Guatemala and arrived in the United States in 2004. I began dating a man here who I will call Ivan. Unfortunately, he drank and physically and emotionally abused me. One time, he headbutted me so hard it split open my forehead. I ended the relationship but discovered I was pregnant with Ivan's child. Shortly after, I went with a friend to rent a video and I saw Ivan. He did not know I was pregnant. I tried talking with him, but he had another woman with him. I asked who she was, and the other woman said, "I am his wife. Who are you?" I did not know that he was married. He lied and said to her, "I don't recognize this woman." I was upset and I told him I was pregnant with his child. His wife was also pregnant. I asked for an explanation, but he struck me twice in the face. I left the store with my face badly wounded. My friend took pictures of my face and together we went to the police station to report Ivan beating me. If I had thought the police were going to report me to immigration, I would not have gone. The police later arrested Ivan for the crimes he committed against me. He made a plea bargain. Eventually, I was able to ask for a U visa for victims of crime and get permanent residency. On November 25th, 2024, I became a United States citizen. I ask you to oppose House File 16 so others in situations like mine feel safe enough to help the police. I've submitted a longer version of my story. Thank you for your time, Lillian Carcamo.
And thank you. And I've been assured by staff that that statement you read, you know, the longer one, is included in our materials. And that concludes the list of testifiers. And Representative Vernig, you had a question, so please proceed with your question.
Mr. Chair, I think
I will get to you, Representative Freiberg.
Yeah. So I have a question about the amendment first. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Reimer. I have a question about your amendment, and I appreciate that it appears to me as though you were taking the advice of Representative Pinto in the previous committee hearing and amending your bill to reflect that. So the question I have is, what form of harassment constitutes a violent crime?
To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. What constitutes as harassment would be what the actual statute states.
So could you give me an example?
Representative Vernig, we could probably have nonpartisan staff clarify what harassment is a violent crime. I believe it's in the process of finding that section. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment, let me begin with that several places in statute we define either crime of violence or, in this case, it's a violent crime. for purposes of Croft's references and accumulating crimes that are similar, and then that usually triggers some other consequence in law. So the original definition was taken from the firearms chapter of law. And so if you were convicted of one of those offenses, you were ineligible to possess a firearm. And this definition is taken from the Victims' Rights Statute chapter and is a smaller subset of violent crimes. And within that definition of 611A.036, which is the cross-reference in statute, harassment is included. It's 609.749 subdivision 2. And that would, I'm just pulling that up right now because it's not, that's a further crossment. And it has a person who commits any of the acts listed in paragraph C, which directly or indirectly or through third parties manifests a purpose to intent to injure the person, property, or rights of another by the commission of unlawful act. Two, follows, monitors, or pursues another, whether in person or through any available technology or other means. Three, returns to the property of another if the actor is without claim of right to the property or consent of one of the authority to consent. Four, repeatedly makes telephone calls, sends texts, or induces a victim to make telephone calls to the actor, whether or not conversation ensues. Number five, makes or causes telephone calls with another repeatedly or continuously to ring. Six, repeatedly mails or delivers or causes delivery of any means, including electronically or letters, telegrams, messages, etc., through assistive devices for people with vision impairments or hearing loss, or any communication made through any available technology. Seven, knowingly makes false allegations against a peace officer concerning the officer's performance of official duties with intent to influence or tamper with the officer's performance of officials. And finally, clause eight is uses another's personal information without consent to invite, encourage, or solicit a third party to engage in a sexual act with the person.
Representative Vernick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I did watch the hearing, and you repeatedly talked about violent crimes, rape, and murder. Was harassment also what you were thinking about when drafting this?
To the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. When we talk about violent crime and we talk about escalating situations, I certainly think when you hear some of the things that were listed out in that statute, we often find that these situations escalate into potentially a violent crime. Now, one of the testimonies that I had here was Charles Thayer, and his mom was beheaded by a Cuban illegal immigrant who was here and had committed a number of crimes, some of which were felonies, but oftentimes was escalating to the point of that came from harassment, but ultimately escalated to things like domestic abuse, arson, and a number of other things. He was awaiting sentencing for arson when he beheaded America Thayer in broad daylight. So what I would just say is when he lists out the when Nonpartisan lists out the specific crimes that are committed, I think that is an escalating situation, and that is somebody that this bill would open up communication with federal immigration authorities on.
Rep. Vernick.
I think that's it for my question regarding the amendment. Thank you.
And thank you for mentioning that that short amendment came from the advice of Representative Pinto, who is very familiar with prosecution of crimes. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I get to my substantive question, I just want to get in a process question. And I expect the rest of the members on my side of the aisle will get an opportunity to ask questions, and I encourage them to ask to get recognized if they have any. But first, Mr. Chair, you've been generally pretty fair in our previous hearings, and I appreciate that. But your approach in this hearing has not been consistent with your earlier behavior. So my first question is, are you willing to let us come back tonight so we can have a full discussion of this bill?
I am not anticipating that we will be returning tonight.
Why is that? I know that happened in the Public Safety Committee on this bill, and we've had considerably less time than they've had on this bill. I know this is a very important, controversial bill, and I think it deserves to have a full hearing.
Representative Freiberg, because, you know, frankly, I don't take, I guess, the harassment and threats to staff add some concern about that.
Mr. Chair, I have no idea what harassments what staff you're referencing. Like I said, I had my staff check in with the sergeant of office. They said there was nothing in that they knew of that would prevent them from being able to guard this hearing this evening as effectively as they guard all of our hearings. I trust them implicitly to know when a situation is dangerous, and I don't believe we are at that point. And just to let you know, too, if it's a lack of a hearing room, I know Representative Lee had a hearing room reserved for another purpose but no longer needs that. So it's actually this hearing room right here. So we could come back to this room tonight and discuss this bill more thoroughly, as I think this bill deserves. Would you be willing to accept that?
What I would like is we actually spend the time with questions on the bill. Did you have a question for the author?
Well, before I get to that, I'll just say it would have been my preference to have the meeting tonight in general. I mean, most members of our side are, okay. Just if I could finish the sentence, most members on our side were at the Sovereignty Day presentation earlier today. We would all like to be there right now to be showing proper respect to our elected sovereign tribal leaders, but we felt it was important to be here because of how strongly we feel about this bill as well as the previous bill and our desire to understand both bills. So at the risk of causing a faux pas with our tribal leaders, we decided to come here. I know there are multiple people in the room who want to testify, but there was very little notice given to sign up on this bill, even though the bill wasn't noticed 3 business days before it was heard, which is not consistent with House rules. This all seems inappropriate. We did finally get some chances to ask the bill author some questions, which I appreciate, because I do honestly want to know why he wants this bill to become law. I don't think I've seen a member delegate bill presentation duties to an outside party before, and I know some of my members have questions for him. But to your point, I know Representative Reimer mentioned a specific murder. I know that came up in the Public Safety Committee. I know Ms. Patratz Acosta is in the audience and testified already, so I'm wondering if she could come up to answer a question.
Would it appears as if she's approaching the table. Introduce yourself again, and you had more of a clarification on your question, Representative Freiberg?
Yes. I'm sorry, is it Professor Patratz Acosta?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, I should know that. I'm pretty familiar with your institution.
Thank you.
So Professor Patratz Acosta, you know, the murder that we heard reference to was incredibly tragic, you know, we want to prevent that at all costs from happening again. But just my question for you is, would the bill before us have prevented that in any way if it had been law at the time it occurred?
To the testifier.
Yes. Thank you for the question. So before responding, I just want to state that I agree with you. This was a horrible tragedy, and I feel awful and extend my condolences to Mr. Thayer and his family for the loss that they've suffered. Going to your question, would the proposed action in House File 16 have prevented this tragedy, or was, I guess, like stated another way, was the but-for cause of the perpetrator in this case being in the United States? Was it due to a lack of cooperation between state and local law enforcement and federal immigration officials? The answer, in my opinion, is no. And if I can explain a little bit further why I have reached that conclusion. In reviewing the information about this particular case, it appears as though the reason why the assailant in this case was present in the United States and free to commit this crime, it had more to do with the fact that he happened to be a national of Cuba. And to explain a little bit further, the United States and Cuba have had strained diplomatic relations going back to the late 1950s, early 1960s, during the Cold War and the start of the Cuban embargo between the United States and Cuba, and Cuba has a policy of not accepting deportees. The assailant in this case was very much on the radar of ICE. There are mechanisms in place where anytime somebody is arrested, their name and biometrics are run through various databases, and those databases have existed for approximately 20 years, going back to shortly after 9/11. So ICE would have been aware of his presence and more recent arrests for arson. They also would have been aware of his presence because it appeared as though he had an old deportation order and was likely released on something called an order of supervision, which would have required him to report to ICE every 6 months to every 12 months. So this was not a case where we have someone who is a non-citizen who has committed certain crimes and has been charged with other crimes being at large on the streets due to lack of cooperation between state and local law enforcement. It was an issue of somebody being a national of a country where ICE was unable to execute a removal order, and that's why he was present.
So a clarification, during what time period were these previous arrests, detentions, etc.? What time period were those?
Based on my reading of the materials that were part of last week's committee, it appeared as though he had a removal order that was imposed, and this was a removal order that would have been imposed by an immigration judge that could not be executed in 2012.
I'm not hearing a year, month. Can you tell me the year or end months when that happened?
I cannot. I cannot give you a year, anything more specific than the year. It appeared from the materials that were provided and available to the public that he had a removal order that was issued in 2012.
Thank you. With that, the bill is laid over, and we are adjourned.